Chapter 12. They're halfway through an early dinner when Jaster says, without looking up, "I'm taking Arla's place on one of the scouting teams tonight, and I likely won't be back until tomorrow. You needn't leave the light on for me. If we do get back, I'll sleep in my office." John pauses, not entirely sure how to answer for a moment. He watches Jaster, the motion of his hands as he eats, the careful tension strung through him like a live wire, and inclines his head. "All right," he says quietly, and sets his fork aside to pick up his tea, cradling it in his hands as he breathes in the steam. Jaster still isn't looking up from his food, and John wonders a little if Arla agreed to being replaced on the team, or if Jaster simply gave her an order. Wonders, too, if this is related to the way Jaster left so quickly this morning, seething with emotion but not showing it. 5 days until the wedding, and John's husband-to-be is still a mystery, even when John can feel the ebb and flow of his emotions like clear water. He pauses, considering Jaster for another long moment, then casting a glance at the sky he can see through the window behind him. The only clouds are a distant ring on the horizon, but there's still the sort of itch under John's skin that means rain is coming, and he swirls his tea gently, then says, "It will rain, early in the morning. You'll want to bring gear." There's a moment of silence, and then a quiet snort. Jaster finally looks up, meeting John's eyes, and the curl of his mouth is deeply amused. "There is a weather warning for tomorrow," he says, "and I am aware of it. There is hardly such a need for you to spend your awareness on the weather, John." There's heat in John's face, and he looks down, self-conscious in a way he normally isn't. It's one thing to give warnings like that when no one knows him as anything but a Jedi, has a sense of awe regarding him that's only reinforced by saying what he feels in the moment. But if it's unnecessary, and Jaster thinks he's showing off, it's not that, he manages, and tries not to wish for his hood and cloak. It's not spending anything, just feelings. They're there whether I pay attention to them or not. There's a moment's pause, and then Jaster sets his own fork aside, leaning forward slightly. "Feelings," he repeats, and that tone isn't amused anymore, it's intent. "It is the Force giving you a warning, yes?" John isn't sure how to put it into words. "It's knowing," he says. "If we pay attention, we know the shape of the universe and how it will spin. The weather is part of that, or knowing what numbers a pair of dice will roll. You just have to know how to look and what to listen to." Jaster's mouth pulls down in a thoughtful frown for a moment, and he sits back, considering that. "I suppose, knowing that, I can't plan our honeymoon for Canto Bright," he says with amusement, then stops short, a jab of self-recrimination surfacing like a signal flare. John doesn't let him dwell on it, just snorts quietly. "Most Jedi wouldn't use their awareness like that," he says quietly, "or only if someone's life was depending on them winning. Some Jedi care more than others about misuse of the Force, but most would draw a line at gambling. If gambling dens know what we are, most of them don't try to stop us." Interest sparks, and Jaster tips his head. "Misuse," he repeats, intent. "Is there an order standard for when use of the Force is appropriate? Who judges what's appropriate and what isn't? Is there a punishment of some sort for truly misusing the Force?" John hesitates, trying to sort out the questions.
I don't... It means superfluous use. No one judges it except the Jedi in question. But we're supposed to use the Force to help others, and out of responsibility. Using it for personal benefit is wrong." Jaster frowns, and John has to try hard not to look at the way his fingers tap on the tabletop, long and broad, heavily calloused. "You lifted a cloak the other day," he points out, thoughtful rather than accusing, and his dark eyes are fixed on John. John couldn't look away if he wanted to. How does that serve someone else? John can't help a faint smile, turning his cup between his fingers to distract himself. It doesn't, not really, but I was testing myself and how much I had healed, so the intent wasn't to serve myself, but to assess my fitness to help others. But it feels good, using the Force. If your mind is at peace and you open yourself to it, it's like having a whole universe inside your skin, and touching the Force enough to move something is like cracking the window to that feeling for just a moment. Carefully, deliberately, Jaster sets his plate aside, stacking it neatly on the tray. "I will admit," he says, a little wry, "I have almost no frame of reference for the Force as you Jedi know it. Miles has mentioned feelings a time or two, but a warrior's instincts can be trained to notice small things that the brain doesn't actively register, and that manifests as hunches or gut instincts." John tries to think of his instincts solely as a physical thing, grounded in the immediate and tangible, but he has no idea where the lines are drawn, where the Force that he's always immersed himself in stops and his own awareness begins. His awareness has always been the Force itself. There's no difference between them. "It's similar, I think," he says, and rises carefully, more because he can than because he needs to. His wound has faded to a dulled ache, and it's entirely bearable right now. Even standing for long periods in the armorer's workshop, designing Jaster's Vambrace with her, didn't strain him more than he could fix afterwards. Gathering his own plate, he sets it on top of Jaster's, then straightens carefully, but there's only a faint pull of unhealed skin, a low-grade ache that's easy to set aside. And then, light, a hand touches his elbow, and John raises his eyes to Jaster, a little startled to find him so close. Jaster's hand is loose, less a gesture of support than some of his touches have been, but John can feel the 5 points of heat of his fingers, and it makes his breath catch a little, too vivid. The robes Zarin made him are thinner than the patched ones he's used to, and he shouldn't be able to tell the difference with a touch of Jaster's hand, but he can. That hand slides up just a little, and John almost wishes there wasn't a cloth between him and the press of Jaster's fingertips. Wishes, helplessly, that he could take a step forward, right into Jaster's warmth, but he doesn't dare. "You're looking better," Jaster says quietly, and that tone is as warm as his touch. He reaches up, slow and deliberate enough that John can easily see it coming, and tucks a strand of John's hair back and out of his face with a smile. "It's likely best that you can use the Force as instinct with your hair and your face like this all the time, John." John swallows, but looks up. Jaster is watching him, thoughtful, touched with humor, and John manages to get out. "I usually have it up, in a bun, but if I'm undercover, it hides my face." Hides the scars, though he doesn't say as much. Jaster can likely pick apart his meaning well enough. It's not as though the marks of John's life are subtle. Jaster snorts quietly, though there's nothing judgmental about it, just amused. "With the hood as well, I'm sure. You Jedi must take classes in how to appear mysterious. Is that temple standard?" "Yes," John says, perfectly earnest, and tries his best not to smile. "We're judged on hood depth and robe flare. There's an extracurricular unit on cloak drops as well." Disbelief surges, instantly followed by confusion, and Jaster freezes, eyes narrowing. He looks John over suspiciously, and John meets his eyes, not quite able to hide the curl of his mouth. With a sound of deep offense that John has heard aimed at Miles too many times to take seriously, Jaster drops his hand from John's hair, catching his chin between his fingers. He tips John's head, leaning in, and John's breath stutters to a complete halt, all memory of how to make his lungs work deserting him in a rush. Jaster is barely a hand span away, close enough that John can feel the brush of his breath, and those fingers are tight on his chin, holding him in place as Jaster shifts closer, expression severe and mind nothing but amusement. "Are you mocking me, JT?" he demands, though there's no heat to it. He's close enough to kiss, John thinks with a jolt that rocks right through him. If he just ducked his head slightly, leaned forward. I would never mock my husband, John manages, and wants to reach up, to touch Jaster's hair again the way he did last night, smooth his fingers through the short strands. But that feels like too much, too daring a thing, and he settles for tipping his head into Jaster's hold a little more. The brush of a thumb along the line of his cheekbone makes him shiver, unable to help himself, and Jaster's eyes meet his own, impossibly dark and heady. His thumb traces the line of a scar that cuts down over the bridge of John's nose, across his cheek, and then Jaster lets go. He doesn't step away, though, but reaches up, fingers threading through John's hair and brushing it back. You'd best not, he says severely, belied by the faint curl hiding at the corner of his mouth. I've heard that he's a terrible man, ruthless and cunning and remorseless, a true monster. John can't help but close his eyes, leaning into the careful stroke of those fingers through his hair. He wants Jaster to touch him more, wants to take a step close and have Jaster wrap an arm around him, like last night. Wants Jaster to get a hold of his hair or his arm or his chin again, wants him to take advantage of their closeness right now in every possible way. I think, he says hoarsely, that I'm required to defend his honor. As his husband, he saved my life. There's a pause, long, careful. Jaster's hand stills, though the drag of a thumb over the shell of John's ear makes it hard to think. Even if he saved you for a selfish reason, Jaster asks, deathly soft. John opens his eyes, meets Jaster's gaze without wavering. For his people, he says quietly, but he means it with every bit of faith he has. He knows why Jaster is doing this. If there's a less selfish reason for someone to take such an action, I've yet to hear it. Jester's breath is rough, and his fingers go tight for just an instant. Jedi, he says, not quite like a curse, but rueful. You have odd notions of responsibility, don't you? No stranger than yours, John counters, and steels himself, dares to reach up, gently closing his fingers around Jaster's wrist, and the feeling of Jaster's pulse, quick and strong under his touch, is just as heady as the unwavering attention brought to bear on him. Whatever saves the greatest number of people, regardless of personal cost. He carefully, deliberately, brushes his thumb across the pulse point in Jaster's wrist, holding his gaze. It's not only me giving things up in this marriage. Jaster closes his eyes for a long moment, then breathes out, rueful and soft. He drops his hand from John's hair, but turns it, catches John's fingers and draws his hand up, pressing a gentle kiss to callous knuckles. My future husband is a kind soul, he says, and lifts John's hand, pressing John's knuckles to his forehead for just a moment. The brush of his warm breath against John's bare wrist is too vivid, almost too much, and John has to swallow against the threads of heat that wind through his muscles at the feeling. Just logical, John manages, rough, and the kiss to his knuckles was impossibly light, but it's like he can feel the imprint of Jaster's mouth there, still burning. He hesitates, wavers, then reaches up with his free hand, meaning to touch Jaster's cheek. Jaster drops his hand, taking a step back, keeps his eyes closed for a moment, then takes a breath and says roughly, I hope you rest well, John. If we return in time, I'll see you tomorrow for breakfast. Caught off guard, John blinks, but inclines his head. Be careful, he says, though there's no sense of immediate danger around Jaster's mission. Just scouting, and impending rain, and an instinctive sense that says it's good for Jaster to go. Whether he usurped Arla's position or not, it's for the better, John is sure, though he couldn't say why. Jaster breathes out, then opens his eyes, and the sweep of his gaze up and down John's body is almost sharp, something buried under his determination that makes John's heartbeat trip. Then, like he has to force himself, Jaster pulls away hard, steps back, turns. Sweet dreams when you reach them, John, he says, and then he's gone, only the soft thump of the door falling shut behind him remaining. John takes a step, even though he doesn't plan to go anywhere, even though he's not sure what he could say if he went after Jaster right now. It makes him think of Miles's words about being patient, but a little unsteady, John curls his fingers over the spot Jaster kissed, uncertain, that heat still knotted low in his belly. Jaster keeps touching him, but guilt, maybe, wanting to prove to himself that John isn't doing this entirely against his will. John had thought it was obvious. He already told Jaster that no life debt could make him betray his oaths to the Order. Still, Jaster is kind. He's clearly worried, clearly concerned over John's willingness, and he has no way to reassure him until the wedding itself. The Vambrace will help, hopefully. John has to believe it will. Not entirely sure what to do with himself, John looks down at the table, the tray with the piled dishes, and breathes out. Picks it up, then carries it to the door and sets it on one of the tables outside for one of the droids to collect, and slips back into the room. He's too restless for sleep, too restless to sit and read, but not healed enough for the intensity of katas that would empty his mind. For a moment, he thinks of taking a walk, but that's likely too much strain as well, and John needs to be better by the wedding. It feels important. He paces the room for a few moments, spending energy, trying not to think about Jaster close enough to kiss, trying not to remember the heat of Jaster's thumb against his cheek, those steady, dark eyes. Jaster is a handsome man, and John is far too aware of it. Unsettlingly so, after years of never getting close enough to anyone for that kind of awareness to settle. Contact with other people has always been something brief, something to be endured and escaped, but this... John sinks down on the floor in front of the door to the garden, crossing his legs beneath him and closing his eyes. Falling into the steady breaths of meditation is as familiar as his own heartbeat, and simple. John can look at the royal of his emotions, name each one, assess and set aside and accept, and it's not the catharsis of movement, but good. Enough. Meditation is something he's done since before he can remember, and in this, at least, Dark Woman could never find fault with him. And then, sharp, heavy, furious, someone bangs on the door. Jaster, Arla snarls, and there's a loud thud. Old man, open the door right now. You're a coward, and I'm not going to let you... John flicks his fingers, even as he carefully pushes to his feet, and the door opens. Arla's fist misses the next bang, and she takes two steps in, bristling, faceless in her helmet but simmering with wrath. She looks around the room, and her gaze lands on John, rage ratcheting up. He's gone, isn't he? She snaps, stalking across the floor to grab John's arm. What the criff does he think he's doing, sidelining me? That's my squad. John twitches as her hand goes tight, but lets himself be dragged towards the door regardless. He didn't tell you, he asks, and that suspicion from earlier is settling into ruefulness. A stray thought before, but clearly not wrong. Of course he didn't tell me, Arla growls, because then I would have told him to stuff his avoidance right up his shebs, because he clearly won't put anything else up there and make life easier for the rest of us. John winces, not about to touch that. It's just until the wedding, he offers, but going by Arla's sound of fury, she isn't impressed. He's an idiot, she snaps, then pitches her voice up as they turn the corner. Miles, where is he? Miles turns to look at them, lowering his pad. Glances at Arla, then at John being towed behind her, and snorts softly. Gone, he says, half an hour ago. Everything you want to tell him, I already tried. Not everything, Arla says, viciously sweet. If he's not even going to trust me to lead my own squad with the Death Watch around... You know that's not what this is about, Miles says, almost gently, and casts another glance at John. His mouth curves, and then he asks, "Were you intending to take a hostage to convince Jaster to reconsider?" "I was going to tell Jaster that I had caught you and the Jedi sucking face," Arla says, unrepentant even when Miles sighs like he's been martyred. "Just to see his expression. Where is he?" "I'm not telling you," Miles says patiently. "He left you to oversee the compound, Arla. You can't leave. Django isn't in any condition to think, is he ever?" Arla mutters. Miles ignores her pointedly. "About security, and John shouldn't be standing either. I'm busy with the wedding plans. You're the one in command here." Arla lets go of John with a huff, folding her arms over her chest. "I should be in command of my squad right now," she says sharply, but some of the venom has faded. "He's an idiot." "More right now than most times," Miles says dryly, and steps forward, catching John's elbow. "John, he told you?" John inclines his head, not sure how to fit what he wants to say into words. "He's restless," he manages, "and still guilty." Miles huffs, rueful and wry. "That's what I thought, too. Just give it another few days, and we can keep him marching in a straight line long enough for him to see sense eventually." "And in the meantime," Arla says sourly, "I'm stuck here, babysitting." "It's not babysitting when it's your brother," Miles says, with the air of having said it many times beforehand. "Then it's just being his sister. And besides, the medical droids are doing just fine on their own, so you can focus on security." "Oh, I will," Arla mutters, turning on her heel and stalking away. "I'll make the security so criffing tight that Jaster won't be able to skulk back in here with his tail between his legs without everyone seeing. He is going to regret this. And I had to find out from Silas, which means Django is going to know." The sound of her voice fades around the next corner, and Miles snorts quietly, shifting his grip on John's arm to support him more easily. "Sorry you got caught up in this," he says, wry. "She's Jaster's daughter in so many ways that sometimes it's inconceivable that there's no genetic relation." John is getting that sense as well. "What she said," he starts, and then pauses, not sure how to phrase what he wants to say. Miles casts him a sideways glance, one brow rising. "About telling Jaster she caught us in a compromising position," he asks dryly, and John nods, relieved he doesn't have to put it into words. Miles just snorts, leading John back down the hallway. Jaster would never believe that sort of accusation, and beyond that, he's well aware my tastes run in a different direction, a more feminine direction, usually. John lets himself feel a flicker of relief. He hadn't thought Arla would say anything that Jaster would take as immediate fact, but better to be sure. He nods, and Miles gives him a crooked smile, pushing the door to Jaster's rooms open and steering John in. "Is there a threat?" he asks after a moment, quieter than before, and pauses to watch as John takes the last handful of steps and sinks down on the bed. "No," John says, and he's certain of that much at least. "He's going to get wet, but that's all." Miles sighs, rubbing a hand over his brow. "That idiot," he says. "I told him to take rain gear, but he was sure the rain wouldn't start until tomorrow." John tips one shoulder, because there's only so much that can be done to change someone's outlook. Maybe getting rained on will be a more immediate reminder for Jaster. "There's still a threat," he offers softly, "but it's not to Jaster." Miles's smile is crooked. "Better than Arla's on the warpath, then," he says with good humor. "She'll make sure no one gets through." John considers that for a moment, then asks, "Where do you normally sleep?" For a long second, Miles doesn't answer, frowning. "You think it's that dangerous?" he asks. "Tonight." John shakes his head. "I'm not sure, but you said there was likely a traitor." "And if there's a traitor, it won't matter how tight Arla's security is," Miles says grimly. He blows out a rough breath, then says, "I'll see about moving Django to a room for the night, and I'll sleep in the bunk room. Arla will be up with the guard, so she should be fine, but I'll warn her too." John nods, because that's about all that can be done. Arla and Django are both shatter points in all likelihood, and need to be kept safe. Jaster will be fine. No one even knew he was going out, and clearly even Arla doesn't know where his squad is headed to scout. It will be enough. Miles breathes out heavily, dragging a hand over his short hair. Less than 5 days until the wedding, he offers, and his gaze is sharp as it rests on John. If you're planning to disappear into the night, now's the time. John doesn't get offended, doesn't hesitate. I told you I was staying, he says quietly. I'll protect Jaster. This is where I'm needed. At that, Miles looks faintly troubled, but he nods regardless. I certainly won't argue about that, he says, and steps back. Glances around the room, then pauses and sighs. Is there anything else you need? He asks. Food, or tea, or better excuses than Jaster likely gave you before he disappeared into the night? I think Arla already disposed of all the potential excuses, John says, amused, and can't help but smile when Miles pulls a face. I'll sleep early and try to heal myself the rest of the way in the morning. Jaster should be back by then, drenched and at least a little sorry, Miles says with good humor. He's never been much of one for camping in the rain. Good night, John. Good night, John says, and watches Miles retreat, closing the door behind him. That itch of restlessness is still under his skin, and he wants to get up and pace, wants to move, wants to find Jaster, but... Jaster is safe, he tells himself, and breathes out. Rises, but only to change out of his robes and into sleeping clothes. There's no need to dwell on Jaster's empty side of the bed, and no need to think about him out in the rain somewhere, watching the perimeter of the complex. It was his choice to leave, and it will be his choice to return. Still, even knowing that, John can't help but close his eyes as he settles beneath the blankets, still able to feel Jaster's touch on his face, on his hand. He curls there, breathing in the sweat and metal scent that Jaster always seems to carry with him, and then reaches out, splaying a hand over the other pillow. Psychometry has never been John's gift, but he thinks he can feel an impression of deep peace, of contentment, of ease. And it makes him smile just a little as he settles in. There's a mind approaching in the darkness. The strangeness of it brings John awake in an instant, every sense alert. He stays perfectly still where he is, attention trained on the hall outside, because whoever is out there is thinking of dark things, has dark intentions. Is thinking of slipping in unnoticed when anyone already here wouldn't bother. Realization settles, calm and steady, because Jaster leaving was what made him safe, and John simply didn't register the connection at the time. Now it seems obvious, and he keeps his eyes closed even as the stranger's mind pauses outside the door. They know where they're going, which is another sign that there's a traitor somewhere within the true Mandalorians that Jaster has surrounded himself with. But this isn't someone John has met before or has even felt in the complex. An outsider, an intruder, and as the door creaks open, John breathes in, breathes out, and focuses. A quickly disappearing shaft of light falls across the foot of the bed and then vanishes. And John can hear someone breathing. For a long moment, there's no movement, no sound. John stays still, waiting, judging intent, and there's a trace of fear that's quickly squashed, a fervent edge, a touch of determination. And then, ever so quietly, a step. John curls his fingers into the sheet, judging distance, time, intentions. There's a flicker of anger that's tamped down, a spark of light off metal. John rolls, throwing himself sideways off the bed, just as the knife flashes down and drives deep. End of chapter 12.